Okay, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show. 086 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text number, or you can give us a call on 074 91 25,000. We're joined by two guests in studio now. Andrew McNulty, Programme Manager at Waterside Theatre. Good morning to you.
Morning, Greg. How are you?
And also Owen McGillah McBreeja. Oh, Owen McGillah McBreeja, Board Member and Trustee with Amar Clan Guidor, that's correct, isn't
it? Yeah, it's Amar Clan Guidor, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not far well off it. Okay, listen, you know yourself, everything happens really quickly here.
Yeah.
1 minute I'm saying hello, next minute I've got two gentlemen sitting in front of me, but that's good. Okay, talk to us about what's coming up. We'll start with you, Andrew.
Okay, thanks for having us on the show this morning, Greg. It's great to be here, and it's great to get the opportunity to talk to you about our project that is coming up now. We have a play, and they are actually going to go on stage now in about 25 minutes for the first show down in Arklan Guidor. And this has come about as a partnership between Waterside Theatre, where I work in Derry, and Arklan Guidor, where Owen looks after the place and is a trustee down there. We kind of together came up with an idea for a cross-border project funded by the International Fund for Ireland. And we worked with very closely Stephen Barrett, who's the Communities and Partnership Programme Manager for Donegal. And together, collaboratively, and with Paul McCool and Ian Barr as well on our side, we kind of threw out ideas and we came up with four distinct parts to a year-long project. And this play, Observe the Sons of Ulster, Marching Towards the Somme by Frank McGuinness, is one element of that. And thankfully, we're here. We're extremely tired. We we left the theatre last night very late in Guidor. I'm a Balfama myself, but I work in Derry. So it's been an absolute treat to work on this, to work with Owen and the team in Arklan, and to discover this play. And we have a brilliant director, David Grant. He's senior lecturer for drama in Queen's. And he has been guiding the whole process all the way through, and our production manager Fiona Harkin as well has also kept the rest of us in check, making sure that we're doing our job well and that everything is on track for it. So we're at the beginning of a tour with it, and we're very excited about it, but very tired, but very, very excited.
Talk to me a little bit about the production, Owen.
The production, it's actually, I'm very happy with the production.
That's always there's, a good start.
There's a great team. Andrew already nearly mentioned, I was going to say, you're going to leave me nothing to say. We've gathered a great team, and it's in this project and the production, there's a learning process. There are four professional actors and four amateur actors, and they paired up, and the amateur actor is learning off the professional actor. David also incorporated that in the production. The acting, I think, is amazing. The lighting, the whole aspect of it.
And because I presume that is a challenge in the scene that you're trying to set, within the confines that you're trying to set it.
Yeah.
And for people to feel immersed in it and actually believe that what they're viewing, that you know, they get that.
Yeah.
It's a challenge that would be way beyond me, but anyway.
The characters are very distinct, and they have to be. It was Frank McGuinness. His writing is fantastic. He create these characters, like... Just for example, I don't want to ruin the show on anybody, but there'll be two guys from Belfast walking, and you know they're from Belfast. The boys from Coleraine, the mixtures of the status as well within the Orange Order, and the within the Protestantism, and it shows why they went out for different reasons to fight in the First World War. And it's just a lovely piece of writing. And then David has taken it, and I respect him. I've worked with David before. I think he, poor fella, had to struggle with me as a director, but I really respect him and admire him as a director. He has a very keen eye. And you mentioned Fiona Harkin. She's one of the best, as far as I'm concerned, the best in the Northwest anyway, as a stage manager.
Mm-hmm.
The lighting is... You don't notice the lighting. And that's, from a lighting point of view...
You've hit the jackpot.
You've hit the jackpot. Yeah. it blends in well with the atmosphere.
Mm. So the four elements of this, Andrew, observe the sons of Ulster marching towards the Somme. This is the play element of it, the performance side of it. The other three elements are not performance sides of it. So talk us a little through and where are we in this year, by the way? Sorry, okay. You talked about this being a year-long project.
Yep. So the play is actually the second element in it.
Okay, so first was the overseas trip.
Was the overseas trip, and that was excellent in that it brought the two groups of individuals, predominantly where I work is in a unionist community mm-hmm. in Derry, and it was to bring that community along with a Gaeltacht community together. It was about the experience of going to the battlefields in Flanders, to go into the Somme, going to Ypres, and together we, I suppose, explored the themes that come straight through the play, as I say.
And what is the what are we trying to achieve here in joining these communities in this environment? What is the hope that to come from that?
At the core of this is peace building. At the core of it, it's identity sharing, and it's respect for cultural diversity.
So is it about sharing history?
Yes, it is that shared
understanding history.
It's about understanding each other's history, because I would even find in my own work, my history and the history that I was taught in my Donegal school is not the same as the history that my CEO has, for example. So it's about coming together.
Makes for good staff parties.
It really does. I know it is. It's really, really good. And it's funny. It's that perspective, and it's creating that understanding as well. And in knowing why we think the way that we think. And that is at the core of the conflict resolution. It's at the core of peace building. And it brings us on then very nicely onto our next part, which is capacity building for the arts in the Northwest.
Okay, can we come on to that? Because I want to make sure that I make sure that people can mark their card. So before we talk about the dates, maybe you want to take this one, Owen, or you can pass it if you wish. The story, what part of history are we told through this this production?
Well, it's during the time, it's set in the First World War in 1916, and at that time, we obviously know the Somme. That's where it's set in 1916, when 1st July, when they go over the top, and just prior to that, and they know they're going to die, most of them, but they talk. There's a unity there because they're all fighting for their beliefs and their culture and their identity, and that is that they are Orange men, and that's the play itself. You were chatting about the two communities. It's what I learned a lot is a lot about their culture, and they're learning about our culture, like. There's even a line in the play about the Germans using Irish language, you know, and they speak Irish. There's humour, there's misunderstandings, and the play tells us all of this, and it helps with us learning from each other, and we're not bad people, and neither are they. Like, you know, we grew up, for example, I grew up. Because of the Irish history, 1916 happened. Most of the people that fought from Ireland fought for different reasons. Some were fighting for to keep Ulster unionist and British, whereas other people went out from the Irish side thinking they were going to get home rule. And these people were forgotten about because of what had happened in the Irish history at that period. And afterwards in 1921-22, there was a man who was born in Gidore who'd moved to Letterkenny, went, fought in the from 1914 to 1918, returned home, said nothing. Nobody knew that he had won the Victoria Cross until after his death.
Mm-hmm.
We should have been celebrating those people as well, because they were fighting for Ireland, for what they believed was the right cause, the right reason.
Yeah.
And in preparation for our trip away, we had we worked with the International School for Peace Studies as well on the overseas trip to make everybody aware of just exactly what a woman was talking about. There was a lot of propaganda around then too as well, in that Save the Women of Belgium was one of the taglines. Save Catholic Belgium was another one. So there was a lot of propaganda. There were economic reasons why people left Ireland to fight.
It's really quite interesting in that causes and fears are still utilised to this very day to try and motivate people. Nothing has really changed. People think things are new, but they're not at all. So there's a matinee which is taking place in the next 20-odd minutes. So you'd have to be quick to get there at this point if there was any availability. So we might focus on later performances. So there's a further performance tonight in Gwydor, if that's yes. correct.
Yep,
then on Griannon Theatre on September 24th and 25th. Are they matinees?
So what
is the motivation, by the way, for the matinee performances?
So what was important for us is to reach out into schools and community groups too as well.
That makes sense.
And that's why we had it. And they're at a reduced rate also. So it's breaking down the barrier to participation too as well, which falls in line with the International Fund for Ireland and assisting us and funding us too as well for this.
It's also in the curriculum in the North. It's also in the curriculum, and as far as I know.
Does it contradict it, I wonder?
I know. So it creates that cornerstone for a lot of debate, and that's the reason for that.
Yeah, exactly. So that's on Greenon Theatre, both matinees, 24th and 25th, am I correct?
24th is an evening show.
Okay,
so
sorry
be...
to confuse it. It's just the way it's written in front of me.
I know, no, I think I had sent it through that's Greg, okay. so I take it.
No, the Millennium Thought Forum, Derry, Londonderry, then September 27th, a matinee and an evening performance. So certainly as it relates to on Greenon Theatre, get on to their box office, you'll see when the shows are and secure tickets there. The same with the Millennium Forum. And in relation to this evening's performance in Gwydor, is there availability for it still, I wonder?
Owen's looking after that. Yeah. And okay.
There are
that's
still,
something to do for a Thursday evening.
Yeah.
Because I think sometimes when we talk about things that are historic, it can be a turn-off for people a little bit, but this is from both of your testimonies here, this is an entertaining and thought-provoking show. Sounds like even if you didn't have an interest in history.
Yeah, the acting is superb. It tells a life story, it's just
in this context. Yeah. Isn't
and
it?
It's about the thing that the director wanted from day one was to paint a picture of people, give the human side behind those individuals that were stuck in the trenches. You may or you may not agree with their reason for being there, but by the end of it, you will be on side with these men. And there's 9 actors in total, but 8 characters in it. So it's an interesting device that Frank McGuinness has used in this, where he has recollection coming back in it too as well. So it's, it has that kind of imaginative approach, but it also has that humanistic approach, and it makes you think. Yeah.
And the 4 pro actors, 4 amateur actors, what was the logic there?
The logic there was what we wanted to do, and it's that capacity building too as well. Our idea was that a lot of young actors in the Northwest can't get the opportunity to step into a professional environment.
And there's a mentoring role there as well.
And it's a mentoring role. Okay. It's a full professional production wrapped around these trainee actors to take them through and build capacity for the arts in the Northwest.
Okay, so Observe the Sons of Ulster Marching Towards the Somme. Is that what it's called?
Yep.
Yes.
That's what it's called, okay. And it is on tonight in Gwydor. It's in Letterkenny, September 24th, 25th. And it's in Derry in the Millennium Forum on September 27th. How do people go along tonight? I'm not sure if you have an online box office.
Just if they land at the door, they'll get the tickets.
Roll up. Right, so then the other elements to this, vocational skills training in theatre and arts management, is that part of this? Is that separate? And then the creative writing workshops through numerous languages, English, Irish, Ulster, Scots, Derry, Eastern, like all Gwydor, they're all there.
They're all there. Yeah. So they're the different elements. And we're very excited about the vocational training element too as well, because that's taking young people from Derry, from Gwydor, and the classes in Gwydor as well will be through the language of Irish, which we feel is massively important. We're going to have a bilingual approach in Derry too as well. And we're linking in with Culturelin and Derry too as well to deliver those. And they'll be qualifications that individuals can pick up in their spare time if they have an interest in the arts, and it might just ignite some interest for someone along the way.
Yeah, I'd love if from an elective perspective, they would that we could sort of replicate what's happening on the ground, because with frequency I have conversations about initiatives like this, and it would just be great if this work was being supported and endorsed all the way to the very top, because I think we'd move much quicker to a better place for us all. Right, so anything else you want to add, Owen?
Well, it was just when we were in Belgium as part of it, it was the 25th anniversary of the signing of the peace initiative, a peace agreement. So we took part in the commemoration over there. Okay. And also we...
Conference.
And I learnt a lot.
Mm.
I had to come back and rethink my thinking, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. My beliefs. And it was amazing. Just the whole trip was so informative and so amazing. And I learnt so much. And I want to be able to share that with others. And...
And anything you want to add, which is actually really quite impactful, that Owen. You know what I mean? It's remarkable.
And just to continue on what Owen was saying there, Greg, I mean, it is about the human being. It's about that change. It's about that evolving. And it's about...
It's like, do you know what kind of, like, you know, if you're ever kidnapped, I know this sounds strange, right, but if you're ever kidnapped, you try and, to the person that's kidnapped you or in the media, if they try and appeal to the kidnapper, they try to humanise the victim. Mm-hmm. To give them a, because then it might moderate their behaviour, because they see that person not as a thing but as a human
being,
and it's proven psychologically effectively to work. Is this a little bit like that, in that we're not just talking about words or what we've been told, we are seeing, even if we disagree with people or we have differences, we are seeing them as a fellow human, as a person who's at the very least views perhaps deserve respect.
That absolutely gets to the core of it, Greg. Frank McGuinness.
You see, I told you I was going somewhere.
It absolutely does. He wrote Someone Who'll Watch Over Me, which is based on Brian Keenan as well. So it's exactly what you're talking about. It's bringing that human being to the fore. And there are things in this that will shock you. You'll be going, whoa. But it gets you to question your own thinking around it. And each of the characters goes through a complete, total and utter 180 journey.
Yeah, and with the case in point with Owen, he's went through that experience in different ways. Okay, so Observe the Sons of Ulster Marching Towards the Somme. There's a show tonight in Gweedore, and then there's shows on the September 24th and 25th in Ongreanon, and then there is a show then on the 27th in the Millennium Forum. And if anyone wants more information about the programme as a whole, Andrew, where would you signpost them to?
Yep, what I would say is go into Waterside Theatre's website or Arklink & Door's website, make contact directly with either theatre. We would be absolutely delighted to talk to anyone about this project, Owen, as I'm sure you would.
Yeah, well, I'll pass the book on to you.
Okay,
that's vice versa. All right, Andrew McNulty, Owen McGillabridge, thank you very much, both of you, for calling
in. Thank you so much.
And continued success with it all. And it's clear that it sounds like something that is, you go through a bit of growth simply being involved in it, not necessarily consuming it. All right, thanks very much. The council is being urged to buy a 40-acre town centre site in Milford. This for the provision of additional housing and a new primary school. The calls come from independent councillor John O'Donnell, who's on the line with us now. Good morning, John. Talk to us about this site and what's its current status.
Morning, Greg. Yeah, the site's for sale with Robinson Estate Agents, and I just think that there's a window of an opportunity here for the council to acquire the site to, number one, deliver for much-needed social housing in the area, but also for the delivery of a new site for an education campus, which will be needed further down the line in relation to the National School in Milford, and also further expansion to the Loretto Community School. So I think we'd be silly not to capture this opportunity to acquire this land at such a, you know, such affordable price for the council.
What kind of feedback have you had from the council? I don't know what their status is or how active they are in sort of, you know, bidding for land on the open market.
Yeah, well, look, the feedback I got was that I suppose that in relation to land for social housing, they were going with a number of different mechanisms. One was an expression of interest that people could do. Number two was that they'd be checking to see what's available in local estate agents. And then the third one would be that they might identify a site and then approach the landowner to see can they acquire it. So I suppose for transparency, it's very transparent that the site's on the open market. It's within the proximity of the town centre, and it's in our remittance at the minute to visit the it's up for public consultation at the minute in relation to the settlement and town boundary framework on all towns and villages in the county. So I think for the council now is the time for us to capture it and acquire this land at a good affordable price.
What is the, I mean, how time sensitive is this, do you think? Because you know yourself, there's various arms of the council and one has to talk to the other about whether it'd be suitable for this, that and the other, and God knows how long that might take. Is there an urgency here, or maybe, I don't know if you're familiar with the landowner, are they prepared to sort of wait and work with the council on a potential transaction?
No, well, I haven't had no negotiation with the landowner at all because it's on the open market. I did call a estate agent about it, and like, it's the closing date for the offers is tomorrow, Friday. But I have spoke to the council about it. They've told us on Tuesday that they have made inquiries about the particular site. I'm hoping that that's. I don't think they'd be misleading us, and I'm hoping it's true. You know, because like the land, the gate price of the land, $750,000 for 40 acres in Milford. When you give it, when you weigh things up, we bought 8 acres in Letterkenny for $4 million, which is $500,000 an acre. We're getting serious value for money here. We're getting this less than $20,000 an acre, as you say, Greg. Plus, we have an opportunity to get our money back in profit if we sell some lands to the Board of Education for the school campus that's going to be needed. Like, the schools are growing, and our population's growing, so it'll be silly of us not to capture this opportunity as a local authority, because then the answer they did give me as well, they said that the housing need in Milford, you know, it wasn't massive. But what I would say to you is there's a massive barony in Milford when you take in Cranford, Carrigart, you have Kerrykeel, you have Rathmullen, you have Remelton, you have Kilmacrennan. Them's all feeding villages that people are on the housing list that would be more than happy to take up a house in Milford if we can get the land of that size at the right money, you know?
Okay, well, sure. See, they haven't ruled it out, I think, by the answer they've given. They've sort of said they're looking at lots of things, which doesn't necessarily include or preclude this. We'll see how it progresses. Thanks for your time this morning. I appreciate it.
All right, thanks, Greg. Take care.
Councillor John O'Donnell there. Just to let you know, there's a coffee morning in St Mary's Hall, Kincaslet. It's running until 2 p.m. It's in aid of Donegal Hospice, so get along to that if you can. My political views are right-wing violent protests achieve nothing, only at the ballot box. You hurt them. Yesterday was a bunch of very frustrated people who were wrong what they did. If a right-wing stands in the next election, I'll have no hesitation to vote for them. It'll be interesting to see if people of that political more right-leaning, it's right-wing, left-wing. I don't think it helps anyone labelling people like that. But say people that have more right-leaning views, if I can put it like that. There, if they stand, how will they get on? I don't know. I really don't know. Greg. Everyone wearing high vis. Yes, everybody should, for to save their own lives and to give all vehicle drivers a fair chance of seeing them. But the RSA need to get their act together while they are promoting their campaign Be Safe, Be Seen, because they don't have any. And it's not just me saying this. I was interviewed on another station on that very subject yesterday after your show, by the way. That's okay. And another caller said the exact same thing. The RSA don't have any high vis. Only for 4 to 6 year olds. Not good enough at this time of the year. That comes in from Mary. See, the guards were on to us and told us that there's some available where. Oh, I can't remember and I don't want to mislead you. But there was some available somewhere. Right, okay. We are going to be talking to the CEO of the Crime Victims Helpline after this short break. Now, the Crime Victims Helpline saw a 78% rise in hate crime calls last year, according to new figures. Michelle Pokaber, I believe it is, Chief Executive of the Crime Victims Helpline, joins us now. And my apologies, Michelle, I didn't check your surname before I read it. I hope I didn't do a terrible job on it.
No, sure, you're grand. No, that's perfect. We'll accept pretty much anything with a last name like Puckhaber.
Puckhaber. No, I'll know for it again. Puckhaber. Thank you very much indeed. Now, yeah. I mean, on the face of it, the headlines read a 78% increase in calls. And this is not in any way to diminish anyone's experience as to why they might call, but it is from a relatively low base. So what do the figures actually tell us, do you think, Michelle?
Yeah, you know, the National Crime Victims Helpline provides information and support to all victims of crime in Ireland. So we are a very good kind of starting point for people who maybe aren't sure where to go. So I would say, you know, in 2022, we saw a really large increase in a lot of our different crimes that seemed very alarming at first, you know, that it was, gosh, that's an exponential growth from the previous year. But what we think is actually happening is just a greater awareness around particular crimes. So it was, you know, hate crime, racist hate crime, LGBT hate crime. So we think, you know, last year the conversation around the hate crime legislation really was making the news, and it was, you know, seeping into kind of conversations that people were having and awareness about this as well. There was a very high profile, you know, homicides, LGBT homicides that occurred. So, you know, it was more, I think, around awareness, and people are having, being able to have a language to discuss maybe hate incidents, hate crimes that they're experiencing. And then hopefully knowing, you know, that this is not okay. And there is places that you can turn to get support, to get information, that nobody has to suffer alone. And
what I think too is happening now, Michelle, is that I'm not sure there is a hardening of views in relation to matters concerning, you know, gender, sexuality, race, ethnicity, whatever that might be. There seems to be people now are more prepared to vocalize them, if you know what I mean. I don't think there's a great change in attitudes, but I think we're seeing the curtain pulled back a little bit now, where people feel empowered. That's a terrible way of describing it, but I hope you understand what I mean. To actually offend people, to say what they feel, to use social media in that regard. You know what I mean? It's like, it's almost like it doesn't matter if there's damage to someone, because it's such an important issue. I need to say this. Do you get where I'm coming from? It's just that's the atmosphere change I've seen in this country in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I would hope that wasn't true. And I would say that, you know, my expertise is around the individuals that are impacted by these crimes.
Understood.
You know, the Crime Victims Helpline, we take each person, provide them with, again, that empathy, non-judgmental support. We can answer questions about the criminal justice system, and then tell them about the other specialized services for victims of, you know, the variety of hate crimes. So I'm, you know, you would hate to think that sentiment is growing, and you would hate to think that it was been there all along. You know, what we do here is that in the past few years, you know, there's been a lot of trauma for the country as a whole, in terms of, you know, we came from the COVID lockdowns straight into a housing crisis, into inflation, and there's a lot of suffering. Mm-hmm. And I think that can be expressed in a lot of different ways. And people can, you know, express themselves in a lot of different ways, and some of them are quite harmful and quite harmful to other people in the community. So, you know, we do hope, again, moving forward, that we're not seeing an increase in this type of crime or these types of incidents, but that we do hope that people continue to reach out if they have been impacted.
Unfortunately, an increase in those areas is demonstrable if social media, for example, is a reflection of society. Michelle, why might someone contact the Crime Victims Helpline rather than the local Garda station, for an example? Because I know Pulse has been updated to recognise a lot of the crimes that people might contact you about. Is it because they don't necessarily know how they'll be treated or how it might progress? Like, why would someone contact the Crime Victims Helpline before the guards, or do they do it at the same time? Or what pattern do you see there?
Yeah, so the Crime Victims Helpline is an independent charity. People can contact us anonymously. They can speak to us in confidence. And what we see is that people come to us in a real variety of places within the journey in the criminal justice system. So some people have not told anyone. So they will ring us and we will be the first people that they talk to about maybe a crime that has happened to them. Maybe it's something, an abuse that happened to them in childhood. And they're now at a place as an adult where they want to talk about it. And they want to see, you know, maybe is this something that I can report still? And is it something I want to, you know, report still? And then we would also hear from people who have already made that report to the guards. They want to know what's going to happen next. Maybe they're a little bit unhappy with the response they got. They kind of want to know what else they can do. And then all the way through the criminal justice system to say somebody, the offender has been caught, they've been convicted, and there's been sentencing. And maybe someone's very unhappy with the sentence that the person got. And they want to know, is there anything that they can do? So there's a really wide variety. Okay. But you know, as an organization, our volunteers and staff who, you know, take the calls and support our service users, you know, we are not here to tell people what to do. Mm-hmm. We can explore options and we can help people know, like, what to expect, you know, depending on what choice they make. But again, we're non-judgmental. We don't tell people what to do.
But I mean, like, you can see at the moment, there's a massive push in terms of advertising to make people aware of the crime of non-consensual sharing of intimate images. It's in English and Irish. I'd expect an increase in that area to be reflected in your figures next year. That's probably the kind of way this works. The more awareness is, the more people come forward to the police or choose to go to the Crime Victims Helpline.
Absolutely. Now, we've seen an absolute explosion of people contacting us about non-consensual sharing of intimate photos. So last year, there was a 275% increase in calls relating to that. And we've seen that trend continue into 2023. And what we're seeing is two separate things. We're seeing sextortion, which is where intimate content is shared online with someone that you don't particularly know well. And they immediately turn around and say, look, give me money or give me gift vouchers, or else I'm going to share this with your workplace or your entire social media. And then we also see, you know, people who have exchanged intimate content in a relationship. And then once the relationship ends as a means of punishing the other person, it's weaponized. That's a really good way to say it. So, you know, both of those things are not okay. We get calls all the time about both of those and their crimes and their support available.
Okay. So if people want to contact the Crime Victims Helpline, Michelle, how do they do so?
So we can be contacted on free to call number 116006, which is the EU-wide number for support for victims of crime. You go to any EU country, dial 116006, mm-hmm. you'll be connected to the victim support services in that country. And people can also go to our website, crimevictimshelpline.ie. They can send us a message, they can send us a text, they can web chat with us. We want people to be able to contact us in whichever way they feel most comfortable.
Okay, Michelle Pokeba, thank you very much for your time today. I do appreciate it. 086 60 25,000. The phone line's hot today. Good morning. You say the people who support the immigrants aren't heard of. Of course they are heard. What they want is happening. Are the immigrants not flooding our country? 39 different nationalities in a Galway school. Mohammed, the number one boy's name in Galway. So tell me whose voice isn't being heard. Well, it's not the number one name in Galway, by the way, because facts do matter. It's the number one boy's name in Galway City, in a maternity hospital there, where a small fraction of babies in Galway are born. Galway County, it's not. It's your Aoife's and your Jack's and stuff like that there. But there is one. There's one maternity hospital based in Galway City that does report that. So you are correct if you're just talking about that one hospital in the city. St. Mary's National School, Ardra, is also a major concern. A tragedy or accident waiting to happen. There's no footpath on the side of the road where the school is located. Young National School children leave the school and cross a major road to a tiny small footpath. A lot of speeding vehicles passing on one side of the road as the other side of the road is fully occupied with parked vehicles that are collecting children. Right, okay. I will go on to our next item, but I'll tell you, I'll take a very, very quick break. Please, if you've texted in, it's a busy show, you know that. We will get to them, if not today, and I'm continuing to get through them. Certainly, we will return to them tomorrow. But I just want you to know that no texts have been ignored. We're just, it's just so busy. Now, history will be made later this week as the first ever joint committee meeting on social protection, community, rural development and the islands will take place on Aranmore Island. Deputy Dennis Nocton is Chair of the Committee on Social Protection, Community and Rural Development and the Islands. Quite the mouthful, but that is the way things are nowadays. Deputy, thank you very much for joining us. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Right, OK. Pretty significant, this, isn't it, to have an official Oireachtas business conducted on an offshore island?
Well, it's actually very significant in that it's the first time that official Oireachtas business in the terms of a live broadcast has taken place outside the city of Dublin ever. And it's nice that where something happens for the first time, that it's happening on an offshore island rather than, you know, in some of our other cities around the country, which is usually the case. But the members of the Joint Oireachtas Committee were determined that they want to visit as many of the offshore islands around the country during the term of this Dáil and Seanad. They want to know about the issues and challenges that people are facing on our offshore islands, and they want to see that reflected in a change in policy. And as part of that, we're using the opportunity to travel to a number of our islands, but also to exploit the fact that we now have decent broadband infrastructure being rolled out across the country, use that technology to have a live Oireachtas broadcast from Aranmore Island tomorrow, and people can look at it live on Oireachtas television on their television channels. And I believe, I'm told, that it's the very first live parliamentary hearing that has been broadcast from an offshore island anywhere in the world. So we're not just first in Ireland, we're first globally in relation to this.
Yeah, OK. Now, before we talk about the various strands that will be discussed, what do you see as the future or for the future of our populated islands?
Well, I think that they have a very positive future. Now, I know there are a number of challenges, and we'll talk about those in a few minutes, that we need to address. But I think now that we are bringing fibre optic cable to every community in Ireland, including our offshore islands, it doesn't make any difference whether you're on Aranmore Island or any of the Aran Islands or any other island, Tory for that matter, or whether you're working in Dublin City Centre or in New York City. If your job involves sitting in front of a computer, you'll be able to do that anywhere. And we would hope that that will lead to, you know, young families coming back to rural communities across the country, and in particular to our offshore islands, you know, rejuvenating the population there rather than seeing population drain, which historically has been the case.
And I think too, islands want, from my conversations with islanders, they just don't want to be seen as tourism destinations whereby there's a massive influx of people at one time of the year, and then for the rest of the year, it's a skeleton population almost. They want to see, you know, more diversity in it. And it kind of sounds, people might say, well, you should be delighted you have the big tourism industry. From the people I speak to, they want to see more to it than just that.
Absolutely. And look, the tourism is the lifeblood of many of these islands during the summer months. And look, people have to make hay while the sun shines. But however, the sustainability of the islands requires having a sustainable population throughout the year, ensuring that the schools remain open, that the community services remain in place. And housing is probably the single biggest issue that our committee is hearing as being the biggest challenge on our offshore islands in terms of accessing existing housing that may be there that requires refurbishment, or giving the opportunity to young families who are either connected to the island or wish to rear their families on the island, being able to build a new home on those islands. So it is a specific issue that the committee will be focused on. It's one of our strands of our hearings tomorrow, is that issue of housing and maintaining a sustainable population on our offshore communities. And that's vitally important. Broadband provides the facility to make that happen, but unless people have homes that they can reside in, that isn't going to benefit them.
Yeah, and infrastructure and everything else that goes, that's an expectant of modern life. Also, too, here locally, we've had controversies, particularly as it relates to Tory Island, where, you know, a helicopter was getting serviced, or there was a mix-up or what have you, and then there's big gaps in health provision on the islands. Now, obviously, we can look at different options. We'll always perhaps need someone on the island or visiting the island or whatever to see people in person. But there are different ways too that healthcare can be provided on islands. I understand that'll be a topic for discussion tomorrow as well.
Yes, we have already visited Clare Island off the coast of Mayo, where we've been looking at a very innovative project involving the University of Galway and the Clare Island community, looking at trialling new innovative technology that allows people within the island communities to attend outpatient appointments remotely rather than having to travel to Letterkenny or Galway for appointments, but also looking at providing more emergency care in our islands. And look, you will always need a trained medical practitioner insofar as is possible on our islands. But how do we try and support that? How do we try and assist the emergency services, particularly the Coast Guard, in providing services on our islands? And technology provides huge opportunities in terms of not just emergency services, but particularly in relation to chronic care, ongoing illnesses, where people may have not got the care and attention that they would have needed in the past. And the great thing about it is, if we can solve this problem in relation to our offshore island communities, these can be replicated in isolated communities in County Donegal, in my own county of Roscommon, and right across the country.
And that's
as well.
Logical. I mean, we're not suggesting the islanders are guinea pigs here, but I mean, if we can make something work, and I think that feeds too into Module 1, climate neutrality and biodiversity, whereby sometimes I think on the mainland it's like herding cats, whereas on an island situation, you know, you can get pretty much the population into a room and look at what they can collectively do in terms of climate neutrality, biodiversity. And then it is measurable because of the scale of it. And again, who's to say that that couldn't have positive consequences for the rest of the population?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I've been advocating in the Dáil is that, you know, where communities go over and beyond what is required under law in terms of dealing with these issues in terms of climate neutrality and biodiversity, that there should be an actual cash payment back to those communities. And it is much easier to manage that in the island communities. One of the issues that I was directly involved with as Minister for Energy was involving our offshore island communities in an EU-wide project to make all of our offshore islands sustainable from an energy perspective, that they're completely independent and not reliant on electricity coming from the mainland. And hopefully in the future, we'll be in a position to export electricity from the island communities onto the mainland as well, providing additional income and additional cash flow. And that's something that we will be looking at tomorrow as well, because it's about trying to make our island communities sustainable in terms of population, in terms of income generation, but also in terms of climate and our environment as well.
In relation to that, what did historically, one of the things that did historically sustain our islands, for an example, was fishing. Now, I maybe fishing can fall into one of these modules. I don't see it sort of, I don't see it sort of expressly written down in front of me as the, pardon the pun here, but as a boat sailed in relation to that, when we're talking about island and island life, are we looking beyond the traditional industries that supported island life? Because there's a lot of bad feeling out there.
Absolutely, there is. Now, the policy in terms of the marine and fishing comes under the Department of Agriculture and the local minister, Charlie McConnellogue. It sadly doesn't come under the remit of our committee. But I do know that there are a number of colleagues in Leinster House who are very animated in relation to that specific issue. But what we're trying to do is to look at new opportunities that are there in terms of innovation and technology that provides opportunities to provide sustainable housing, to provide, you know, sustainable employment for people, and to ensure that we have long-term sustainable communities, which of course does involve the development of our marine industry as well.
All right, it's on Oireachtas TV tomorrow. It's a historic first ever joint committee meeting on social protection, community, rural development and the islands, or any committee for that matter, taking place on an island globally. I don't know about that one. I might have to fact check that, Dennis. I think there could be, you know, some government in some far-flung country. Maybe they're listening and might contest that. But Sir Luckett, come here. Were you in the?
We'd love to hear from them if they want to contest it. But from my research, I think it is.
Were you in the Dáil yesterday?
Yes, I was in the Dáil yesterday.
What's your reaction to how events unfold there? It's dominating conversations today, as you know.
Yes, look, it is dominating the conversations to date. And there is a provision under our constitution where TDs and senators cannot be impeded going to or coming from the Dáil. Now, that was put in at a time when there was, you know, civil war in this country and, you know, a lot of animosity around the country at the time. But it was put in for a very specific purpose to ensure that people could get in and out of Leinster House. Neither TDs, senators or staff could do that yesterday. It's not good. It shouldn't happen. And it is imperative that we don't allow a handful of people who have a particular agenda, which is to undermine democracy in this country, to be given the physical tools to do that. And we would hope that we can address that and hopefully that the courts will deal with the matters that are presently before them as well.
But it's important too, though, that people still maintain the right to protest
absolutely.
Peacefully
absolutely.
And express how they feel.
I would be someone who would be absolutely adamant that we should maintain the right to protest. That should never, ever be restricted. And it's about now putting measures in place that allow people that have legitimate business inside in Leinster House to come and go, while also facilitating very legitimate and peaceful protests that have historically taken place outside Leinster House. I was there when the pensioners were there. I was there in many of the protests down through the years, and they should be allowed to continue.
All right. Thank you very much for your time. Good luck tomorrow. We appreciate it. Okay. That was Deputy Dennis Nocton there. And that is where we have to leave it on the programme today. Thank you to all of you who listened to the programme, got involved in the conversation, watched it, however you engaged. It's all greatly appreciated. We're back tomorrow with the Friday panel discussing some of the week's or days or whatever happens overnight. We're going to be across some of the big topics, of course. Please tune in for that. That's from 9 o'clock, and there's plenty more. There's plenty more besides. That's entertainment coming up after 11 as well. But for me, Greg Hughes, and Caroline Orr, who researched and produced the show, and Niamh Shields working flat out as well, have a great Thursday. John Breslin's next.